Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, Managing Partner at VS Strategies. As always, we want to give thanks to our partners at Rootworks, who are helping make this podcast possible, as well as our amazing producer, Josh, who is, as always, killing it on the audio files. We have a really cool show today. Very excited about this one. Trying a slightly new thing here at the Weed Wonks, where in addition to kind of our more long-form episodes or very long-form episodes, depending on how long I plather on for. We're trying to do some shorter hits with some friends and colleagues of mine when I come across an interesting idea, an interesting concept, something that piques my interest, and I'm excited to share and kind of promote the ideas they have, as well as kind of get other people thinking about these things. And so I would say about a month or so ago, I was yutzing around on Marijuana Moment, like you're supposed to if you're a good policy person, in the morning, and saw something written by my good friend Douglas Fisher about a recent court case. Douglas is general counsel at Advanced Vapor Devices and a founding member at Vape Safer. And so he had this piece, this policy piece, this op-ed about tobacco vaporization and kind of court cases and decisions there and how that might impact cannabis. And so I sent him a message and said, hey, man, will you take an hour out of your day to come on the podcast and talk about it? And, you know, he was kind enough to humor me and willing to sit through what was probably some silly questions I might have and join us today. So, Douglas, thank you so much for taking the time. What you put together was awesome, and I'm really excited to kind of share with the audience the thought process that you've gone through and kind of what is going on tobacco in terms of vaporizers and how that might inform some things coming down the pike for us on the cannabis side.
Oh, thank you for the kind words. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about it. I love this stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so you've been in cannabis for a long time. We've known each other for close to a decade, which ages us probably more than we'd like to. But before we get into the actual op-ed, can you just give a little bit of that history of kind of where you started, how you got involved in cannabis, and how your career has evolved to the point where this is really something that you are one of the people thinking about this at the highest levels in the cannabis space? But that's not a flipping a switch, right? You worked pretty hard over a very long period of time to get to this space. And I think it's important to share that with the audience.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, it's been about 10 years for me in the cannabis space. Just personally, always believed in the power of the plant and have been involved with it, you know, pretty much my whole adult life. Career-wise, I was an attorney at a big law firm in Washington, D.C., Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft. And I was in the, you know, what they call the white collar group, which is really a lot of, how would I say it? Misunderstood capitalists were my clients, right? And
that was really well done. I just have to say, like, the political nature of your word choice was exceptional right there. That was top.
And it was funny because I ended up just kind of very, just as a matter of the work I started working on as an associate there, I did a bunch of DEA regulatory work, and these were mostly pill mill type cases. We worked for some drug distributors that didn't maybe have the controls in place they should have. So I got a sense of DEA regulatory, and I worked with a mentor who formerly was very high up in the DEA. And then I was also doing some anti-money laundering work, doing defense and investigations for banks and financial institutions that found themselves in trouble or under investigation for perhaps not sniffing it out amongst their clientele. And so this is, you know, early 2010s, and you start realizing, wow, DEA plus anti-money laundering, there's a real moment where these two skills are coming together and becoming very valuable to an emerging industry, that being cannabis, of course. And so I just started kind of getting really interested in it, just one, because like I said, I like it, and two, I had some skills around it. Eventually had some friends that were investing in the space and was able to turn them into clients and get more work on it. And that just set me down a path where I said, this is the future of my career. Like this really gets me going. I'm engaged intellectually. I find it satisfying. I think it's a great movement. I think it's something as a country we're moving in the right direction on generally, which makes me happy. And so from there, I did the work there at a big law firm for a few years, trying to kind of build a practice, and they didn't really see it. They weren't necessarily opposed to working on cannabis, but they didn't understand what the industry was going to become or the potential of it. So did that for a few years, hopped to a small startup that was sort of a hybrid industry association, reg tech play. And then from there, I joined a company called Greenlane, which got me into the vaporization world. Greenlane was at the time probably the largest distributor of cannabis vaporization products, among other things. And we did an IPO on the NASDAQ, which was the first time sort of an explicit cannabis ancillary business was listed on a major exchange. And just ran the gamut there. You know, there was some policy work, but also just the legal work you'd expect in that type of job. Securities laws, corporate governance, employment, IP, all of it. And it was a great opportunity because, you know, having the resources we did, I got to be involved with all these great organizations, Marijuana Policy Project, NCIA, so on and so forth, and get to know folks like yourself and others. Did that for about 4 years, spent some time as the general counsel of Ascend Wellness, which is an MSO you may be familiar with. And then about a year ago, joined Advanced Vapor Devices. So back into the vapor world. I just really love the business. I really love the people. I thought it was going to be a really fun and engaging, exciting challenge. And so, you know, somehow I found my way into a niche within a niche, which is not just cannabis, but cannabis vaporization.
Yeah, well, a niche that's growing. And I think that that's an awesome place to start because you have this background in kind of DEA kind of control, anti-money laundering, right? Then you come along and you get involved in, you know, both the business side, but really tech development, regulatory assessment, interaction between businesses and regulations. That's a really important thing, especially if you end up as a general counsel. Like, you get pulled in a million directions. That's the nature of a GC job. But having that background in regs, you can almost tell sometimes the GCs that have some policy experience versus those that don't. And there's probably advantages and disadvantages. I see things through a policy lens. That's my background. So I always find that really valuable because you can really help on a variety of fronts. And you kind of, it helps you understand not just what the law says, but why it says that way. What's going to be triggering for regulators, where risk comes from that maybe you don't see, right? Because there's the risk that's on the page that lawyers can identify, but there's also the what happens when the world changes risk and how do you predict that and how do you see that coming? And that gets to the piece that we're going to talk about. But to be able to do that and move, then to take a company public, to work with Greenlane and now at AVD, you know, it's a breadth of experience that I think really informs why you're such an expert in this area. You know, it's not like you woke up one day and said, I'm an expert. We have some of those in cannabis. You know, you really think
we do.
They're always fun. But, you know, the real experts work their ass off and study and work really hard to kind of develop these skills over a long period of time. And it's very evident. And so you were taking a look at something that happened on the tobacco side recently. And I think that that's really important. Because we're at a new phase in cannabis, right? And that phase is we have basically kind of set the stage for eventual success at the federal level. We have a good sense of what a regulated market looks like. We have a good sense of where our public health risks are. We have a good sense of what regulations we need to kind of address some of those at the state level. We obviously have a lot to learn. It isn't to say that there isn't, you know, years and years and years of educating ourselves to do and probably things that we never thought of. But we've come a pretty long way. And we've come so far that we are on the precipice of federal legalization. Now, what that precipice is, that could be a very long precipice or a very short precipice, depending on Congress, which we will not put a lot of stock in, per usual on this podcast, because we certainly have some concerns about them and when they might move forward. But we are, you know, we have a very good system. That system gets replicated in some level of consistency around the country. But things could very much change at the federal level. And so when I read this op-ed that you put out, which we'll, I'm sure we can share a link in the notes and everyone should check out, and we'll kind of get into the reality of it, it really reminded me on something earlier on in my career when we were kind of figuring some of this stuff out. And very early on, we saw that cannabis programs usually shift from a medical program to an adult use program. And that medical programs, and as we were kind of deciding how to do that, people were asking people at our firm, hey, how do you do, like, what are the lessons learned? What are the best practices? And one of the things that we kind of identified early on was you don't necessarily want your public health department to be your marijuana regulator. There were a lot of medical programs that have been given to the public health department And then there were other medical programs that have been given to a more kind of business regulator, people who do liquor enforcement, people who do taxes, people who oversee highly regulated industries. And while the input and perspective from the health public health folks was incredibly valuable, we saw that there was at least some kind of a trend where those programs struggled from an operational and economic perspective, because the folks in the public health department, that's not the thing they care about at the most. Business regulators tend to be a little bit more balanced, taking all the different things that matter into consideration, all stakeholder perspectives, all kind of values. Public health regulators put public health first and foremost. That's what they're supposed to do. But when you regulate a business, that can become kind of concerning. And so we started recommending to people, hey, make sure, especially when you transition to adult use, if you're in a public health department, you want to make sure statutorily that you move to a more business regulator, but that you keep the public health department looped in. Don't get rid of them. Just have them be more of a stakeholder in the mix, sharing information and value as opposed to the ultimate decider. And I think one of the main takeaways, and maybe we'll start at the end and then work backwards, was what you were suggesting is that at the federal level, what that really means is we'll use, you know, straw people, the FDA versus the TTB here. There are obviously other ways this could go, but those are, you know, kind of big names in the space. And you were saying, hey, there's some risk here. If we end up with the FDA, we need to pay a little bit more attention to it. So maybe let's start with what that conclusion was, and then we'll go back to the case, just because you probably can articulate it a little better than I did.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I think that's right. And, you know, the FDA is, you know, Food Drug Administration Act. They get tobacco under their control some years ago, right? And then it's a rapidly evolving market. Suddenly you find out, okay, now there's these e-cigarettes. You know, we'll get more in more detail the case, but what ultimately happened was they issued over many, many years a series of conflicting, inconsistent guidance, trying to give companies producing these goods, you know, the roadmap to how do you get them approved. These companies spend untold millions on it, trying to follow the FDA's guidance, and ultimately almost all of them are rejected, and there's hardly any products on the market that are FDA approved. And to me, this is almost like, it's as close as you're going to get to a one-to-one correlation of what you could see happen with cannabis, because the FDA, to your point, as a health regulator, is really laser focused on a few items, and they sometimes miss the bigger picture. You know, when the FDA is regulating food, great, I'm glad there's a list of ingredients that are safe. I'm glad that there's good manufacturing practices for our drugs. And those are types of things that I think have a place 100% and a critical place in a cannabis regulatory regime. But there's a lot of other factors you need to look into that just aren't either as a result of their mandate or just their field of vision aren't being considered. And so what happens is, you know, people within the FDA make a decision, a value judgment almost, that flavored e-cigarette products are negative. And despite there being no authority to ban them, that's effectively what happens. And, you know, that industry hasn't helped itself by any means. There's been a lot of irresponsible actors in it. But nonetheless, you know, the decision making came from, to your point, only one narrow perspective about what's good for the public health, at the expense of both many other important factors, even including, I'd say, a much broader conception of harm reduction and what's actually good for the public health rather than just one factor of it.
Right. And I think, you know, fair enough, we're both attorneys, so we'll do a little disclaimers. One, we are not here to opine on the moral righteousness or lack thereof of the e-cigarette and tobacco industry. We are not here to suggest that cannabis is 100% harmless and completely safe. I think you and I both exist in a world where adults make decisions, and sometimes they make decisions that are unhealthy. And the question is, how do we manage public policy around it? And that's kind of where this intersection comes in. But let's take a step back. So the first thing is, especially in the e-cigarette realm, unlike rolled cigarettes, unlike raw tobacco, in the e-cigarette world, the FDA has significant regulatory authority. In fact, I don't think they have much regulatory authority over just regular cigarettes. They have a lot of regulatory authority over vaporized tobacco devices. Is my very limited understanding? Yeah,
yes close, and no. So
close
they,
enough.
You know,
okay, so yes and no, yeah, is close enough.
Yeah, I mean, if your combustible cigarette product has been on the market for a long time, that's absolutely correct, right? All these products are grandfathered in, these products that are extremely dangerous.
Okay, there you go.
And so that's why you can still get a pack of Marlboros out there. There's no serious scientist who would tell you the Marlboro is better for your health than an e-cigarette. But right. You're right. The authorities cabinet, that product's grandfathered in. It's not going away.
Well, and look, things like just maybe because I'm a progressive libertarian and it's my made up political party that doesn't exist. I think adults, you know, should be able to do unhealthy things. They shouldn't. But, you know, if you pay your taxes and take care of your kid and are a decent neighbor and family member and are good to your mom and dad, which is important, you got to be good to Mama Dukes. You can't be mean to her. You probably should be able to do something unhealthy. Like, you probably shouldn't drink tequila and you probably shouldn't smoke cigarettes and you probably shouldn't eat bacon cheeseburgers from McDonald's. But, like, you know, I think, you know, we are entitled to make unhealthy decisions as an adult as long as we check the, you know, decent human box. And in that frame, people are allowed to smoke cigarettes. They're grandfathered in. Vaporizers and e-cigarettes are not, right? And so I think that's where this kind of situation comes in, is they're trying to figure out how to regulate e-cigarettes to help make them safer. The thing is they're e-cigarettes. They're supposed to be unhealthy, right? They're like, no one's trying to suggest that they're healthy. They may have harm reduction values, but you get in this natural tension, I think, with public health folks when you have a product that is not supposed to be healthy. And they're trying to figure out how to regulate it through that public health lens. So they come out with, I guess, oversight, because there's a big controversy around flavors. On the one hand, adults like flavors. On the other hand, flavors are attractive to children. And how do you create that balance? So what was the first step in that process that the FDA kind of said, hey, we've got some concerns here about these flavored e-cigarettes?
Yeah. So, you know, under the Tobacco Control Act 2009, essentially, and this is where the grandfathering comes in, FDA is told any new tobacco product that hits the market, and that includes e-cigarettes as well as, you know, traditional tobacco products, you have to have pre-market approval for, meaning that if it's not essentially identical to one that exists, if it's not grandfathered in, you need to go to the FDA and give them a justification called PMTA, pre-market tobacco application. And so that's the case for all tobacco, because for supposedly rolling papers, although it doesn't really happen there, it's the case for pipe tobacco, and it's the case for e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes got rolled into this in 2016, I believe it was. And so starting around then, the FDA began publishing a bunch of guidance and saying, okay, if you manufacture e-cigarette products, whether it be e-liquids or pod-based systems or disposables, you need to give us an application. We approve it, you know, and we'll approve it. And by the way, we'll grandfather you in terms of enforcement discretion. We're not going to enforce the law needing an approval if you're on the market before we issue this guidance, right?
And I think that I don't want to move past that, because I think that is a absolutely critical point to drive home, that you need to get pre-market approval. So you need, before you sell your product, you need the FDA to give you a thumbs up. So the only way a rational, insane person would invest significant dollars, because the pre-market approval is not cheap, is if the FDA comes out and says, hey, this is the kind of stuff we're looking for, right? Like, no one would invest money in trying to get approved if you don't know what the boundaries are, right? Like, what is good? What is bad? What are we looking? What would likely lead to approval? What would likely not lead to approval? So people can produce products in that vein. They can conduct their research in a manner that's consistent with the FDA's expectations. So those guidelines are really, really critical for people willing to make significant seven-figure plus investments in getting this approval process. Without that kind of guidance, without that guidance being something that's sticky that you can rely on, you're really spending a lot of money just kind of guessing. And, you know, the smart money usually doesn't spend that kind of money just guessing. So they've got these guidelines, and then you're supposed to follow them. And then if you do consistently, you would assume you would get approved. Only if that happened, we probably wouldn't be talking about it. So that's not what happened, is it?
No, that's right. Well, and, you know, even before you get to the non-approvals, the guidelines are shifting regularly too, right? So there's guidance that comes out. You know, overall, between 2017 and 2020, you could count it a little bit differently. There's roughly, let's call it, five significant events where the FDA is dropping written guidance for people who are seeking approval of their e-cigarette products. And through all of these, they start talking about, oh, you don't need any specific type of study. We want data that shows, oh, it's not going to increase tobacco usage, right? That maybe if you're an e-cigarette company, you're shifting cigarette users over to e-cigarettes, which again, harm reduction, right? Or, and the other big one, of course, is that it's not appealing to children. You're not adding new smokers. So great. Maybe you're getting some adults to cease smoking cigarettes and do something that's better for them in the form of an e-cigarette, but you've also added new nicotine users who are vaping, right? So we want to see that. But they were consistent. No, you can show us your marketing plan. Like, what are you doing to make sure it's not getting in the hands of kids? What are you doing to make sure it's advertised responsibly? You can draw inferences from similar types of product and how those market. They never said, oh, you need, you know, a longitudinal study or any other specific type of study. And they, you know, changed in nuances the type of things they'd like to see for, you know, this period from 2017 through 2020.
And then just in the normal world, people change their minds regularly. A federal agency the size of the FDA issuing 5 shifting guidances over that period of time is significant and anomalous and shows a lack of stickiness as businesses are making these investments in terms of that guidance, right? That is, you typically do not see that. Usually these guidances are not some willy-nilly decision that someone just fired off, right? These are really, a lot of work goes into them. And the notion that it would change that much in such a short period of time is anomalous and inconsistent with the time investments and what we would usually see from a federal bureaucracy of that size and sophistication.
Yeah. Yeah. And the charitable explanation to that, you know, for the FDA would be, well, the market was shifting so rapidly and the technology was changing so rapidly and the marketing practices were becoming less savory. So we had to change what we were saying. Fair enough to an extent. But one, some of this is, you know, can be anticipated. And two, you're a federal agency. People need to rely on what you put out. You don't get to, and this gets into the case a little bit, you don't get to just simply like change your mind all the time and then expect people will be held to the standard. This goes back to your point about a business-minded regulator. That's not, people can't operate in an environment, an industry can't operate in an environment, which ultimately leaves consumers unprotected because the only people who are operating it are ones who are just ignoring the regulatory regime altogether.
And it's incredibly important. Regulatory certainty is something that we talk about a lot, and it's critical for investments. It's critical for people to make good business decisions, is they have to have some level of regulatory certainty. We don't want regulatory agencies, even like the FDA, stuck in the mud and not reactive at all. But at the same time, there has to be some level of balance, some level of forewarning. Otherwise, you end up in the situation of you know, like we see in certain cannabis markets, of what I would call regulatory failure. The regulations are unrealistic from a business perspective, and the regulations cause market failure, right? And that's what we're starting to see with some of these things. So these shifting guidances continue to come out, and then what happens?
Yeah. And then so the big bomb that drops is in 2020, they drop a new enforcement guidance and they say, and this was after some of the stuff that happened with Juul. And so it was clearly reactionary to that. But they come out and basically say, yeah, we had said we weren't going to exercise our enforcement discretion for products that were in the process of getting their application, right? We were going to hold off and not take any action if you're on the market, but you're getting your thing. But we're changing our minds when it comes to cartridge-based flavor products. This
pretty
is brand
narrow.
New. Yeah, this is brand new. So I won't get into second, but there's sort of the tanks and mods. There's people who fill their e-liquids into an e-cigarette, right? They were saying that we're not going to do anything with that. But if you have a cartridge one, because a kid might hide that in their pocket or their backpack, and someone found those in their high schooler's, you know, bathroom and they were doing it, that's out of the question. So and all of a sudden everyone's like, wait, now all of a sudden these products that have been on the market that have been protected by the FDA's guidance previously, suddenly were not.
Right. The FDA was saying you can operate and sell this before you get your pre-market approval, because this entire concept of pre-market approval came on after you were in the market already to begin with. But you have to be working towards it. If you are working towards compliance with the new policy that we've adopted after you came into the market, we will allow you to continue operating as long as you continue to be working in good faith towards getting in compliance. And then all of a sudden, 2020, that moment shifts where they say, actually, we've changed our mind. You either are pre-approved or we are going to enforce against you. for cartridge based ones. I mean, the people who are filling, it themselves, we lost them anyway, right? So we're not worried. Once you get into filling your own cartridges, you're too far gone. We're not going to
work. Well,
obviously, it's kind of facetious and ridiculous, but it's kind of fun.
So that's right. And so, you know, one, that's already a huge shift in the earth in the way things, oh my God, we have. So those companies start scrambling. They say, well, now the only thing we can do is get our PMTA, our applications for approval across the line as quickly as we can and hope our things get approved so that guidance won't matter because now we'll have an officially approved product.
Right. And eventually we're just going to run out of money, right? Like, because we're not allowed to sell it anymore. So we got the clock is ticking big time.
Yeah. So, and at no point has the FDA ever said, we won't approve flavored products. They're just saying, we're not going to, kind of withhold our discretion on enforcement for flavored products. They never said you can't get a flavored product approved. To the contrary, they were accepting applications for the approval of flavored products. Then all of a sudden in summer of 21, just en masse, the FDA denies 50 something thousand applications for flavored e-cigarette products. And then over the coming months, they get to another like 950,000 more denials. And they're basically using as a justification that they don't have specific types of studies to back up their claims that they don't, that these companies' products aren't going to increase youth use, or they're not being marketed towards youth. Never mind that their guidance a few rounds ago perfectly specifically said you don't need those types of studies. So now they've denied over a million applications. These companies have spent, many of them have spent millions of dollars and years of time working on getting these approvals. And the FDA barely, or not even, didn't even read them. They just said, nope, you didn't include that type of information that we wanted to see, so we're denying it. And it's just, you know, I mean, even today, as I recount it for the millionth time, it's flabbergasting, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically you have moving the goalposts, right? And I think that, you know, that's the opposite of regulatory certainty, right? And that's this tension of business environment where businesses are like, just tell me the rules of the road and I'll figure out how to get to the other side of them. But if you're changing them, compliance is impossible, right? In that scenario, and it's hard to get an application approved if, you know, what you had been told the whole time is acceptable only to find out at the end that it's not. And there's lots of abusive practices going on in e-cigarettes. The point is not to morally justify e-cigarettes. The point is that this is a story of something that occurred under the FDA's purview. And then there's a case that came along and then which basically kind of smacked them on the hand. And the courts were like, I don't know if that's a best way to go about things, guys. Maybe we need to take a step back. And so what did the courts say when they looked at this?
Yeah, well, and there's lots of cases that have dealt with this, right? But yeah, the Fifth Circuit earlier this year came out and just eviscerated the FDA. I mean, you know, courts will take litigants to task from time to time, but this one, even for a layperson reading it, would kind of be taken aback, like, wow. And basically, you know, the court recounted the history that I just recounted and said, you FDA need to deal fairly with the market, with the participants in this market. You can't hide behind your broad statutory discretion to do something that is arbitrary and capricious, which is what the court said this was. And, you know, you didn't, you know, you gave guidance just because you put some disclaimers in the guidance that say, oh, we may change our mind. Oh, this doesn't have the impact of a regulation, doesn't give you free rein to change that guidance whenever you want. And then beyond that, to ignore all that after the fact. And so, you know, we find that, you know, the petitioners did submit a good application and they wanted to remand it back. We don't know if it'll get, or we don't know what'll happen with it. But I didn't find the case noteworthy so much for the ruling as I did for how much the court took the FDA to task for what they had done. It's just so illuminating as to what could happen to cannabis, because sadly, there's other circuits that have ruled differently, right? The 10th Circuit, the DC Circuit have ruled on very similar cases and come out in support of the FDA, which honestly highlights the danger even more, right? Because in this case, I think the court got it right. But what I wanted people to realize was to read this decision and be like, wow, this is the fate that could befall the cannabis industry if we're not really thoughtful about who is the right regulator and how their discretion is guided by legislation or by statute because if it's just this open-ended for the public health type of discretion in an agency like FDA, you can see how that's going to end up. It's right there in front of us.
Yeah. And the FDA is doing what it thinks is best to try to help promote a healthy public, right? That is without question what they're doing. And they would probably say that everything that we've done is morally justified by the our end goals of promoting public health. We could argue and disagree with them or not. And there's issues with e-cigarettes and advertising actually towards children and all kinds of gross shit. So let's put all that stuff aside. I think the important part is looking as we move forward, right? And when you have an agency whose mission and focus is to protect public health and has evidenced a willingness to prioritize protecting public health over establishing consistent, fair rules of the road for businesses to operate in, you end up in a very risky situation from an investment standpoint, from a business standpoint, right? That they have a very broad statutory discretion, and an agency and a group of people who are very focused above all on protecting public health. That situation is what created the scenario for tobacco. Whether they probably didn't help themselves or not, for sure. It's why cannabis advertising, I always like to say, keep it classy, folks, is the same kind of thing, where you really want to make sure you're not kind of creating problems for yourself by behaving irresponsibly. But at the same time, there is a huge lesson as we move forward on the precipice, depending on how long said precipice lasts, of federal legalization. Who is our eventual regulator at the federal level going to be? And what is their enabling statute going to look like? Those are questions that are currently without hard answers. And I think the point you made is now is the time for us to start thinking and worrying about this, not after the fact. Because after the fact, it's too late, son. It's got to be now.
Oh, yeah. And I would say I would even support the guiding principle of regulation of vape being public health, just not such a narrow conception of it, right? I mean, it's very easy to see what's happened with the e-cigarette market now, which is now there's a lot of fly-by-night operators because the FDA does not have the enforcement muscle to exclude bad actors from the market. So the people who follow the rules are not putting their products on the market because they're being denied, and you end up with a bunch of stuff on the market that actually is completely unregulated because it hasn't gone through any process whatsoever.
There's actually a bill in Colorado right now that would prohibit and it just came in. So I'm not, the team is kind of like working on it and analyzing it and talking to folks, but actually would prohibit the sale of any non-FDA approved electronic smoking device under Colorado law, which would give Colorado agencies the ability to act upon unapproved devices. Now, they were not intending to include cannabis, but we are not expressly carved out of it either. And since there's nothing really approved by the FDA to use on cannabis, we're going to, kind of work to make sure that we're exempted out of all of this mess. But it's not just this theoretical thing, right? This lack of approved devices at the FDA is creating a market of unapproved devices, which is far worse for public health, right? Regulation works. That's why we're here. And to the point where states are now having to come in and say, hey, if it's not FDA approved, it's also a violation of state law, because it's become such an issue. It's become enough of an issue that states feel like they need to step in too. Okay. That's why when we say we definitely want public health at the table, public health is absolutely a guiding principle. There's no disagreement there, but there has to be an ability to take a step back and not be kind of so binary about things, right? Like, the world is more complicated than just binary yes and no outcomes. And in this case, you have a counterintuitive scenario where they're saying, well, these e-cigarettes and these flavors, they're bad for public health. And I think the point that you're trying to make is, yeah, but the unregulated market is probably worse for public health, right?
And cigarettes. So that's what you're driving people to, is either unregulated products or cigarettes, which we know scientifically are worse, right?
And the public health people would be like, well, you just shouldn't smoke. And it's like, I mean, yeah, man, like, heard, but like, ain't gonna happen. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I don't smoke cigarettes. I quit smoking cigarettes a long time ago. But when I was a cigarette smoker, like, the FDA coming in and my doctor saying, hey, you shouldn't do that. Like, my doctor told me every year you shouldn't be doing this. And eventually I quit. But it wasn't because my doctor kept telling me. It was because it was, you know, that was the time in my life when I chose to make that decision for myself as an adult. The FDA saying you shouldn't, like, everyone's smoking at this point. No one thinks it's like got vitamin, you know, to quote Dennis Leary from many a long time ago, like, doesn't have vitamin C in it and shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, listen, this is the principle I know that pretty much every cannabis advocate agrees upon, which is prohibition doesn't work. And that's effectively what FDA is doing here, right, is a de facto prohibition of these flavored cigarettes.
Yeah. And so as we look at the situation with FDA, we have a loose statute, a public health focused agency that focuses on public health more than anything else. That is their mission. That is what they should be doing. This is not to say they shouldn't be doing it. This is absolutely, they're doing what they should be doing. The problem is when you have a vague statute combined with that as your regulatory agency and no other regulatory agency in the mix to kind of create a little balance, you have massive risk. And what you're saying is, hey, you see this huge risk and problem over here with tobacco, like especially for cannabis vaporizers, which is a big part of our market. There's a lot of risk here that we can't ignore, that we have to start paying a little bit more attention to as we move forward in federal policy. And we talk about safe banking and we're talking about 280E reform. And we're talking about ending prohibition. We're talking about differentiating between hemp and marijuana, which are all cannabis, and the differentiation is a legal fiction, but we're not going to go down that rabbit hole right now because that'll take 2 hours. We have to be thinking about who our regulator is. And in addition, we have to be thinking about statutory specificity, which is a really big hurdle to mount in Congress, right? Because I think what you're saying is, even if we were just in FDA land, if the statute was more specific, that might have helped.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Then you at least have courts back here. But you're right. I mean, I have, admittedly, my dreams and nightmares are probably very bizarre to most people's. But the thing that I wake up in a cold sweat about is that someday everyone's celebrating. We got a legalization bill and it's actually going to pass. And there's some throwaway line in it that says delivery devices, as they call them. Or, you know, maybe they'll, instead of ENDS, you know, electronic nicotine delivery devices, they'll call them ECDS, electronic cannabis delivery device, right? And it just says FDA is going to regulate them. And then you're back into this exact situation that we just discussed, which is no statutory guidance and an agency with a very narrow conception of the public health that may not be all that well informed on the products making decisions. And so, you know, there are lots of different ways in which you could go about regulating this market. From my perspective, the ideal one is for FDA to be involved, as you mentioned, but in a more light touch. Listen, something that the FDA can be very good at is manufacturing practices. All this hardware and all these oils need to be made in a safe manner. There's no question about that, right? I don't know, you know, and then, you know, other things that I think are valuable, look, we need great at, like, we need real rules around marketing and advertising. And guess what? State cannabis markets have already figured that out for the most part, right? There's no, it's not a secret how to do that, right? And you look at a regulatory regime like alcohol, for example, and a lot of people sort of bandy that about as an analog to cannabis, and it has some weaknesses and some strengths as an analog. But in terms of the sort of more light touch federal model, it makes a lot of sense. You don't see contaminated alcohol supplies moving around. You generally don't see it being sold on a gray market or off the street corner. You don't see a lot of illegal additives in alcohol. That's because there's rules around the advertising of it. There's rules around, you know, age restriction. And there's some very basic rules about safe production of the product. And those things combined put you in a much better place than having some unattainable standard where nothing gets approved and everything is shifted into some gray market. And then we're in vape crisis 2.0.
I like to think about things as assumed risk, right? As a cannabis consumer, I am assuming risk that inhaling cannabis through a vaporizer is not safe. Like that is a risk I am taking. I am assuming it. I'm an adult. I'm saying, hey, this probably isn't the same thing as, you know, taking my vitamins in the morning. But at the same time, there are certain risks I'm not assuming. For example, if you produce a vaporizer where the heating mechanism leaches a chemical that causes lung damage, or using an excipient like vitamin E acetate that cause problems, those are risks I'm not assuming. What we want is the FDA to address risks that we are not assuming, that we assume, hey, I'm assuming what has reasonably done to make this product safe is done. I'm assuming the risk that consuming cannabis is not safe. And then I think you create that balance. And that's really what we're talking about here. And so, you know, we don't want to belabor this. I think, you know, the whole point of what you wrote, the whole point of having you on this show is really very straightforward. We want to make sure people are thinking about this. We want to make sure people are aware of this. The folks working on moving legalization forward, the political folks, the politicians, the staffers, the advocates, everybody is saying to themselves, hey, this isn't just about getting it across the finish line. How is important? And in this particular instance, making sure our public health people are involved, but that they either are working in collaboration with other agencies to create balance, or there's a very specific statute that helps them create balance. But something has to be done, because if we ignore this and it just becomes a throwaway line, as you referred to it in the statute, of the FDA will figure out electronic smoking devices or whatever they're going to call them, we could end up in a very dangerous situation. And a lot of money got spent that ended up just being thrown at a brick wall and not getting to the other side. And I think the cannabis industry would like to avoid that and like to have a more collaborative relationship with our regulators to make sure that the standards that they are imposing upon us are surmountable.
I think that's very well said. And I'd add on top of that, I think the approach you just described not only achieves that goal, but I think is also ultimately more beneficial to the public. Right. By ensuring, absolutely, as you put it, yeah, you know, it's funny, but by ensuring more stakeholders with other points of view are included in the process, what you're going to do is make a process that works, that people are willing to participate in, not one that people deliberately stay outside of. And to your point, then, you know, there's unassumed risks that people don't know about and aren't aware of.
Yeah, balance, like everything else in life. Yeah. It's shocking. It just comes up in every area. But like, balance is key. And that if you assess things through one lens and one perspective, you're probably not going to have the best outcome. So, all right, we're going to add a link to Douglas's op-ed that he had in Marijuana Moment that was absolutely fantastic. We encourage folks to read it. We encourage folks to educate themselves about the situation that is currently occurring with tobacco vaporizers. You know, we take no moral position, again, on e-cigarettes or anything else. This is an education in regulatory risk. And as practitioners of cannabis policy, we need to be able to understand and identify efficient regulatory environments that help promote public health and also identify unintended negative externalities that may create greater public health risk than what was the original perceived problem. Right? Lessons learned are really important so we can all wake up tomorrow and try to do better. We think the FDA is doing their best. Props to Norm and all the folks over there for the hard work they're doing. That doesn't mean anyone's perfect. The goal is to get better. And that's why we're sharing all of this out there to just try to help people be informed and help identify solutions before it's too late. Any parting thoughts before we wrap for our audience?
You know, you said it so well, and I agree. I just hope people will pay attention. And, you know, if you have either thoughts about this issue or you are a stakeholder in this issue, Vape Safer is a great place to participate and to either get more informed or participate in the process, vapesafer.org. If you want to check it out or get in touch with me, that'd be great. And no, this is a fun discussion. I'm glad you were able to help bring some light to, you know, what seems like a niche issue, but really is not.
Yeah. Well, super fascinating. Thank you for taking the time to put that out there and appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And yeah, Vape Safer, great fledgling association that's trying to help address some of these things. Great way to get in touch with folks who are really doing the hard work to make sure that the future of cannabis is thoughtful, safe, and well-regulated in a manner that serves consumers as well as the public health. And so appreciate all the work you're doing. Appreciate you taking the time today. And with that, we'll just say stay nerdy, everybody.